Track 11, Charles Cunningham Boycott. Charles Cunningham Boycott, whose surname was added to the dictionary. This month, Chris Armstrong discovers why the Norfolk rector's son's name became part of English language.
Boycott was born in the parsonage at Burgder Street, where his father was rector. It was a family living, several generations of Boycotts succeeding each other as incumbents. One of the joys of research is the occasional discovery of a fact that has no relevance to the topic being pursued, but which brings a smile to the face of the researcher. As the great-grandson of a Norfolk parson, whose favourite book after the Bible was Walton's The Complete Angler, I was amused to discover that, in Boycott's grandfather's time as rector, christenings could only take place on those days when the 14th century font at the Riverside Church was not being used to store the rector's live bait. In a break with family tradition, Charles decided to make a career in the army. To this end, he entered the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich with a view to becoming a sapper. Unfortunately, he failed the relevant examination and was discharged from the academy. His military ambitions were not thwarted. However, the family promptly spent £450 buying him a commission in the 39th Foot. He was just 20 years old. Posted to Ireland, he did not enjoy the best of health, suffering from scarlet fever caught in his Woolwich days, which led to long periods of sick leave and suggested the possibility of future complications. Nevertheless, at the age of 21, in 1852, he married an Irish girl in Dublin. Just a year later, he seems to have become disillusioned with a military career and sold his commission, by this time a captaincy, though his final rank is disputed, to take a property in Tipperary, possibly aided by a family legacy. He was not there long, moving to the remote Achill Island off the coast of County Mayo, at the instigation of a friend, a local magistrate. Life there was tough, and the island itself relatively inaccessible, but Charles Boycott stayed there, renting 2,000 acres from a Protestant mission for about 18 years. His time on the island was certainly not without incident. His original home there was totally destroyed by fire sometime in the 1860s. An archaeological investigation of the site some 150 years later produced a large number of artifacts, among them buttons marked with a crown and stamped with the number 39, presumably remnants of his regimental uniform. Other artifacts found on site included a small number of small pieces of china, probably from children's dolls of the era. Since the Boycott marriage, while apparently harmonious, was also childless, this would seem to confirm the story that guests were staying at the house at the time of the fire. The loss of his house wasn't the only problem with which Charles had to contend, though not all issues are entirely clear. What is clear from reviewing the material I have available is that opinions of Boycott's character and behaviour conform to the late Queen's dictum that recollections may vary. Views expressed in some of the Irish material I have looked at are a lot less sympathetic to Charles than their English counterparts. Among other reported issues were an unsuccessful action for an alleged assault by Charles on a local man and a string of disputes with the agent of his landlord, the Church Mission estate, culminating in an action by Charles against the agent for libel. Several reasons have been advanced for his decision to return in 1872 to the mainland. Among these are the remote nature of the island, with minimal social life, and no opportunity to pursue his interest in horse racing. Another is ambition. He had become prosperous during his time on the island, and may have been ambitious for bigger opportunities. Whatever the reason, he was tempted by an offer from the Earl of Erne, who owned nearly 50,000 acres of land in Ireland, to act as his agent for some property and to farm in his own right in a more substantial way. As a result, the Boycotts moved to County Mayo, where he busied himself farming and collecting the rent for the Earl's tenants. Although Boycott believed himself on good terms with his tenants, they apparently didn't share this view, believing he laid down some petty rules and regulations which he enforced by imposing fines on anyone who breached them. Further, they claimed he removed some traditional perks of their tenancy, such as collecting firewood from the estate. In 1880, disagreements came to a head and Boycott found himself the subject of extreme ostracism. To comprehend the reasons for this treatment of Charles Boycott, which gave rise to the word which took his name, it is necessary to understand a little of the background of the Irish-English relationship in the Victorian era. In a short article like this, I have had to limit my observations to a few words. The Irish question demanded a huge amount of parliamentary time and led to heated differences of opinion on everything from disestablishment of the Irish Church right the way through to proposals for Home Rule. It frequently dominated parliamentary proceedings and threatened the stability of successive governments. The nearest modern analogy to rank with it has, I would suggest, been the interminable issue of Brexit. One of the principal losers in this long and bitter struggle was Gladstone, who not only suffered a series of defeats in his proposed Irish measures, but forfeited totally the goodwill of Queen Victoria, who by the end of the era could barely bring herself to speak to him. Behind the agitation lay two good reasons for Irish resentment of the English. Although at this time still part of the British family, they were condescendingly treated as the poor relations. Worse, they were in many cases the victims of greed exhibited by many landlords. Much of Ireland's agricultural property was owned, frequently in large estates, by absentee landlords, who were among the wealthiest of English residents. In the 1870s, it was believed that just 750 landlords owned more than 50% of the whole of Ireland. A major factor in the discontent was the successive famines following crop failures, which caused widespread deaths and sparked a huge wave of emigration to the United States, Canada, and Australasia. The extreme poverty was exacerbated by the unsympathetic attitude of the landowners, who either refused to reduce rents at all or did so to an inadequate degree. Gradually, the Irish organized and began a land league, whose aims were fair rent, free sale of property, and protected tenure of their properties. The Westminster MP C.S. Parnell, representing Meath, became leader of the Land League and of the Home Rule Party. He was a constant thorn in the flesh of the government. In a speech in September 1880, he implored the League members to refrain from violence, but to harass those who opposed them by placing them in what he described as a moral Coventry. Boycott was, of course, one of those agents employed to manage their properties for the landlords. And the very day after Parnell's speech, he began to serve eviction notices on those tenants who had failed to pay their rent. Lord Erne had, he claimed, declined to fall in with some of the tenants' demands for a 25% reduction rather than the 10% which he had offered, thus angering the tenants. The notices were served by a process server accompanied by 17 members of the constabulary. By the time they got to the fourth tenant, what they were up to had been discerned by the remainder, who attacked the eviction team, throwing stones and manure at them until they retreated to Boycott's house. Then Parnell's suggestion was taken up. First, Boycott's staff left him to cope on his own. Soon, others joined in. The shops wouldn't serve him, the blacksmith wouldn't shoe his horses, the postman wouldn't deliver mail, and life became impossible. The crops were left unharvested, the food had to be brought in by boat, and contact with the outside world was difficult. Boycott reacted in the manner later attributed to the mythical Disgusted of Tunbridge Wells. He wrote to the Times describing both his treatment and his predicament. His letter certainly prompted action, attracting interest from the wider press. One journalist filed a report which, as well as colourfully describing Boycott's personal situation, also drew attention to the unharvested crop going to waste in a country frequently subjected to famine. Whatever Boycott's expectations were of his letter, he can't have been disappointed. Other newspapers, including the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Express, between them raised over £2,000 to help save the crop. A relief fund was set up, and an expeditionary force was dispatched by special train. The government would not permit the expedition to be armed, but undertook to protect the group of 50 men sent to harvest the crop. Boycott was not noticeably grateful, saying he had managed to deal with part of the crop and only needed a dozen or so men to manage the rest. He was probably concerned that a throng of outsiders could make the hostility even greater. In fact, although the team brought in found themselves in a hostile environment, the anger of the locals fell short of violence. The work was concluded, but Boycott decided he'd had enough and left Ireland, escorted and in an army ambulance. It had not proved possible to find anyone willing to drive a carriage, which he had hired. He had intended to stay a short while in Dublin en route, but his hotel was threatened with being boycotted itself, and he visited the United States, where his arrival caused something of a stir, primarily about the use of his name as an addition to the dictionary as a result of the incident. Returning to England, he became a land agent for a Suffolk estate until his health deteriorated, and he died at the age of 65. He was buried at Burgh St. Peter, the funeral being taken by the then current incumbent, his nephew. Judging the nature of the man is difficult at this distance, but I have discovered two very different biographies of him. A man whose donation to posterity is just the use of his name to describe an act of extreme ostracism. One written by a family member presents a picture of an honest and rather jovial man, until the later days on excellent terms with his employees. The other paints a different picture, of a man who treated both his tenants and his employees with a degree of arrogance and disdain. He is described as having an innate belief in the divine right of the masters and a tendency to behave as he saw fit without regard to other people's feelings. Either way, his name has enriched our vocabulary.